This past weekend, those first doses of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine rolled off the line and left the production plant in near Kalamazoo. Some who watched the convoy of trucks got a little emotional, not without reason. This historic moment has brought hope to a year so full of disappointment and mourning. We're checking in today with Dr. Howard Markell, medical historian at the University of Michigan, about the history of vaccine production and what that can mean for us today. Howard, it's great to hear your voice.
Nice to hear yours too, April.
What was your reaction when you saw the images of those trucks in Portage leaving for their destinations?
Well, if I was wearing a hat, I would have taken it off in respect. It is a historic moment because there has never been a faster process from discovering a newly emerging infectious disease and getting it all the way to a workable and usable vaccine in basically under a year. That is a world's record in the history of medicine and vaccines. So it's utterly incredible what they've been able to do.
Knowing what you know about vaccine development and production, I mean, was that a surprise to you? I mean, we knew that pharmaceutical companies were basically all hands on deck for this, but are you surprised at how fast this came together?
Yeah, because it's a difficult virus. It's an RNA-based virus, and we haven't had the best success with that. Another RNA virus, of course, is HIV. We don't have a vaccine for HIV, although we do have pretty good medications for it. So there was a great deal of science, technology, and ingenuity that went to this that developed it far faster than I would have predicted 9 or 10 months ago.
You've had access to some of the research information that maybe wouldn't make as much sense to the layperson. Could you give us a plain English explanation of how this was done so fast?
Well, that is a great question. First of all, there's really three or four different products emerging that work in different and highly technical immunological ways to make the body, the human body, immune to a subsequent infection. But because the science was shared and people were working around the world on this process, scientists in Germany or Israel or China or Russia, as well as the United States and so on, could all communicate and work with one another from the point they discovered the actual genome of this virus very early in the proceedings to the point of today. It wasn't about being first and who gets the credit. As you can find, there's no individual there's no Jonas Salk in this story because there's hundreds of Jonas Salks in this story. So just as everything else in our society seems to be jet propelled and far faster than it's ever been in the past, we're learning that vaccine production has benefited from the same speed.
The thing that seems analogous to this is the polio vaccines rollout and vaccination in terms of a national effort, national information campaigns, and really a national response. By comparison, yes. How fast was the polio vaccine mass produced?
In a way, you know, our first American polio epidemic was in 1916. FDR didn't found the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis as a nonprofit, nonpartisan foundation to not only help people who had polio, but to find a vaccine in 1938. And it wasn't until 1955 that the Salk vaccine was announced at the University of Michigan in Rackham Auditorium that it was safe, effective, and potent. So that's a matter of many years. Now, the science, of course, was less advanced and the process was different, but it took many, many years to do that. And the Salk vaccine was ready in 1954, but a very careful field trial of 1.8 million children around the country was orchestrated by Thomas Francis at the University of Michigan for the national foundation of infantile paralysis, or as we better know it, the March of Dimes, a very appropriate name, because they funded it, not the government, not other groups, all of us, all Americans who gave their pennies, nickels, and dimes. So you see a quote, March of Dimes to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue to lick polio. 1955 was also a very different time in that there was great trust for our government officials, for scientists, and for doctors. You know, after April 12, 1955, every American parent wanted his or her child to become Jonah Salk.
Do you think the fact that polio was so serious as a childhood illness had an effect on how people perceive this?
Yeah, there's no question that polio's primary target of children really helped round the troops toward a singular goal. But the fact that it was a different era where there was much greater trust, less disinformation, less avenues for disinformation than this current vaccination process, I think made it a lot easier. We already know that about half the country is against the COVID vaccine because of not only anti-vaxxer sentiment, but even political grounds. So there's a real challenge with doctors, public health officials, government leaders, and others to get everyone vaccinated for COVID, because that is the only way we're going to kill this violent enemy.
Howard, as folks may have heard, the Pfizer vaccine needs to be super cooled, not just refrigerated, but refrigerated at a temperature far below what a lot of facilities short of hospitals may not have done before.
Yeah. South Pole kind of temperatures, basically.
I seem to recall that the polio vaccine also had some specs. Can you talk a little bit about what kind of challenge that was at the time?
There were challenges in manufacturing the polio vaccine, even though Salk developed a method along with his colleagues at University of Pennsylvania. But the federal government granted six different departments to make polio vaccine, and they were up and running after the announcement was made. It was an inactivated formalin-killed virus vaccine. So while it needed to be preserved, it didn't need these particular deep freeze temperatures. Now, on one level, the government required a preservative called methylate to be added to Salk's vaccine, and that lowered the efficacy rate. And in fact, Salk complained about that. There also was the infamous Cutter incident a few weeks after April 12, 1955, when parents were literally pushing their kids to the head of the line to get their polio vaccine. The Cutter Labs was a company in Berkeley, California, and it was really a slapdash, inappropriately controlled factory where Jonah Salk's right-hand man, a man named Julius Younger, went out and said, "What's going on here? I mean, there's rooms where there's live virus in some vats next to other vats that have killed virus." He really worried about it, but it didn't go very far until they began to notice that many batches of the Cutter Lab vaccine was tainted with live vaccine. Tens of thousands of people got some form of polio. About 200 were actually paralyzed, and maybe 10 died. So they took all of that Cutter vaccine off the market quite quickly. They regrouped, they reinstituted better quality controls, and in a matter of weeks, they resumed the mass vaccination of children. Can you imagine if something like that happened today with COVID? It would stop everything dead in its tracks.
There's enough fear and suspicion out there about vaccines already. I mean, it seems like that would be very dire.
It would stop it dead. It really would. So, you know, we're going to have enough problems with just mild adverse effects. You know, every vaccine has some mild effects, headache or feeling like you have a cold or under the weather. But we tolerate those because the risk of getting COVID is so much greater, so much more deadly than the mild risk of feeling crummy for a day or two. But even those can be misused by the disinformation campaign. So we really have to be careful with how we give the vaccine, how we monitor side effects, and a daily briefing about what's going on and what's working and what's not working and how we're going to make things work.
We know that about 6 in 10 Americans have said that they would be willing to get the COVID vaccine. That's promising. But there is that 40% of people who have reservations at this point.
Yeah.
Well,
let me throw a little rain on your parade.
Sure.
About those 6 out of 10. Okay. In the middle of a pandemic. And that, too, is striking about this vaccine, that it's being developed in the middle of this remarkably, you know, this probably the second worst pandemic in human history, is that while 6 out of 10 are saying they're going to consider getting it now, when there's plenty of vaccine finally available for everybody, and that's going to take a couple of months to, you know, to early or late spring, let's face it, we might see fewer going to get the vaccine. That happens all the time with flu vaccines, for example. In 2009, in the early days of the flu pandemic, 90-odd% of Americans said they would take the vaccine. When it was ready 9 months later, less than 20% got the vaccine. Here's another bit of rain on the parade. The Pfizer vaccine requires 2 shots. When I was practicing pediatrics, I used to call that the pediatrician's nightmare, because a lot of people won't come back for the second.
So what do you think should be the sell for people who are feeling skeptical about one of the various COVID vaccines in this moment?
The sell is this. This vaccine has been vetted carefully by the best minds in vaccine science, immunology, infectious diseases in the world. These are careful men and women who are very well trained to do that. While no biological entity is 100% safe, this one looks to be very, very safe, and it's one I would give myself or my children. The second issue is this. This virus is stealthy and deadly, and it also plays a game of Russian roulette, because even when you contract the virus, you don't know if you're going to be the one who gets sick or just transfer the virus to somebody else, and you don't know if you're going to get sick enough to be hospitalized and potentially die. And as long as we don't nail it, and that means a herd immunity of, I don't like 70%, I frankly like 80 to 90%. If we don't do that, this virus is going to become endemic, and we're going to see fires here and then there and then somewhere else for years to come. So all of the people involved on the science end, on the public health end, on the medical end, they have done a miraculous job. And now it's time for us as Americans to unite during this crisis and do our own miraculous job by rolling up all of our sleeves and getting the vaccine twice, because it needs to be a 2-dose when it is ready and available.
I wonder, is there any concern in your mind about people maybe feeling a certain sense of exuberance now that the vaccine is starting to be available, and maybe doing things that are less safe because they feel like the worst of the danger has passed?
Yes, I do worry about that. And the message is this. We are not out of the woods until hundreds of millions of us. In fact, there's 3,800 million Americans, give or take a few thousand. And I want as many of those 3,800 million to take the vaccine. We're not out of the woods until we get vaccinated. That is the only thing that's going to knock this virus out. And that means until that day that it's available for all of us, we have to continue social distancing, mask wearing, staying close to home, and staying safe.
I know that you've been extremely busy with requests for scholarly articles and essays and all manner of things, and interviews like this one during the course of this year. I know that when you first set your research path into medical history, and especially the history of infectious disease, you probably couldn't quite have foreseen everything that's happened this year. But what's it like to be so on trend?
Well, my daughter says it's kind of cool. You know, it's been the honor of my life. It's been the honor of my career to help explain this terrible tragedy just a bit more. Did I know it would get to this point when I started 30 years ago? No. But when I started doing this research on social distancing about 15 years ago, I knew it was important. but I never wanted a terrible worst case scenario pandemic to try it out. Now that this is happening, it's been incredibly rewarding and gratifying to know that our research helped develop social distancing, and those countries or those places that have ignored it have failed miserably as a result. But it's also been horrifying because hundreds of millions of people have gotten sick from this, and so many of us, myself included, have lost family members to COVID-19. It's been a very interesting time for me.
What are the ways in which the pandemic has challenged you? I mean, I know, as you mentioned, you lost your mom this year, and I'm so very sorry about that. But are there ways in which the conundrum of the virus has been hard for you?
You know, I was saying this to my sister the other day. My mother died in late February, and it was before the shutdown. So we actually could have a funeral, like a real funeral. And I mentioned I was grateful for that. You know, I wasn't happy she died, of course, but I was grateful it didn't happen several months later. But it's only in the recent weeks I've been dealing with my mother's, payments and things, estate kind of stuff. And I have her death certificate in front of me, and it really hit me like a ton of bricks because I've been so busy with, you know, as you said, interviews, writing, committee work, and so on, that I haven't had the time to properly grieve. And I know this is going to be a very weird thing to say, but I'm grateful for the COVID virus for me to be so busy in a way. But it's been challenging. You know, I haven't seen people I love. I do talk to them by phone or by FaceTime. I'm very fortunate that a great deal of my work can be done remotely. But mostly this has made me very sad and frustrated because we know what works. We know how to hide from this virus, but we haven't had the resolve to do it. And I have to say, I might get in a little trouble for this. As a doctor, as a physician, my first priority is and always will be life. And the economy was hurt no matter what. It was hurt when we did social distance. It was hurt when we didn't social distance. But I have to say, above all, as Hippocrates said, first, do no harm. And so it's very frustrating in various states, in various institutions, that people wanted to proceed business as usual or try to do that. And many, many more got sick and or died because of this terrible virus.
Dr. Howard Markell is a medical historian at the University of Michigan. Howard, I know that the holidays are going to be very, very bittersweet for you this year, but we wish you and your family all the best.
Thank you, April, and I wish the same to you and all of your listeners.